You know what he is. Here is a passionate man who believes in life, who wants to help everybody.
Somebody who is making a real difference in the world. We need to be more passionate as people, and I think Mustafa is somebody who's leading that effort.
If I can give you one advice, if you lack passion, call Mustafa.
I've not met a more passionate person in my life.
Being one of these 100 great leaders, 100 great coaches of the future, he's one of the winners.
Mr. Passion.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, good evening, depending on what part of the world you're in. If it's Friday, you know it's a studio series where we bring together the most exciting people to discuss their careers, their successes, detours, U-turns, and today our guest is Mustafa Hamwi, best-selling author and executive coach. Welcome.
Hello, Ron. Hello, everybody.
Glad to have you here, and I appreciate all the efforts you went through. Just to give some background to people watching the show today, Mustafa left Australia, came to Dubai, left Dubai, and he's currently now in India for a retreat, but we'll talk through that. So I thank you for making that effort.
Thank you, Ron, for having me. It's an honor.
So tell us about your journey. I mean, from how did you get to this piece? When you look at the intro of all the key people in that space endorsing your work, how did we get there?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that I always got. And one of the answers I always give is every overnight success takes 10 years. So in a way, people look at it and go, oh, how are these people endorsing you? I'm like, yeah, it's not, can you get them to endorse me? I'm like, it doesn't work this way. This just came as a natural evolution of doing what I do. To rewind back a little bit, I started my career in, well, pretty much as a telesales operator, but I'll talk about the point where it became a strong, meaningful career, is I started handling the public relations for Nokia in the Middle East through... I used to handle also a lot of other companies like Cisco. We used to support on Showtime, Philips, MasterCard, and things like that. But I'm a public relations guy originally. And through that, I got exposed to a lot of nightlife and events because Nokia was the main. For those that I know that the audience of this show is old enough to remember what's a Nokia phone. Because one time I use this example sometimes in my talks, and I used to put the big Nokia communicator on screen. And I did that at a school. I'm like, everybody recognizes this phone. They go, this is a phone? So I used to handle the PR for Nokia when Nokia was the biggest sponsor of all events, parties, concerts that were happening in the Middle East. And through that, I had a lot of access to pretty much every concert and party, and everybody wanted to be my friend. I eventually left the company that I was working for, which was the agency doing the PR, and opened up my own agency. I went from 4 people to 45 people, multi-million dollar turnover in a span of 4 years. So that was from about 2004 till 2008. Through that, I also opened a modeling agency, communications agency. We were partners. Our group they invested in my business, was the initial investor group in the Cavalli Club, the 400 nightclub, and multiple other nightlife ventures. So you can imagine I was burning the candles at both ends, 16 hours a day. Daytime was conferences, summits, seminars. Nighttime was parties, things like that. Eventually, I woke up one day and I'm like, as much as everybody envied me, and I envied myself when I was still young enough in my 20s, thinking like that's the dream life, looks like a video clip, like a rap video clip. But eventually, I'm like, but that's, what am I doing? I feel so empty on the inside. That pursuit for an answer got me depressed at the beginning. I stopped drinking. I got out of the party scene. I started doing some consulting with the government. I still was feeling empty. And I woke up one day and I'm like, I'm buying a one-way ticket to India. So 2012 comes, I buy a one-way ticket to India. I go on a transformational journey. By coincidence, I ended up meeting a guru or a swami who had been in caves for 13 years. That's 13 years. He's been meditating in solitude for 13 years. It was one of those kind of movie moments to say, coincidence or universal alignment. And I'm sitting with him, you know, seeking purpose, more meaning in life. I'm lost. I don't know what to do. I thought I got everything I ever dreamed of, but I'm not finding myself fulfilled. And he goes to me, do you know what you are thirsty for? Because if you do not know what you are thirsty for, you cannot quench your thirst. I remember, and I'm making it with the accent because I remember vividly his tone of voice, his face, yeah. Where we were.
Yeah.
And that was an aha moment because I'm like, interesting. I am, as much as everybody else, looking for an answer. You know the song, yeah? Everybody's looking for something.
Yeah.
But I did not actually know what that was the main question I was looking to answer. I just knew I'm looking for an answer, but I did not know the actual question. So then I was like, okay, what am I thirsty for? What am I thirsty for? What am I thirsty for? And throughout my journey in India, a few months later, by coincidence, walking into a hospital to get my do a normal checkup while I'm there, and I discovered I had a medical condition that was medically labeled as non-curable. I refused to take medications, and it was a shock for me. But luckily, I was in India, the mother of all natural healing. There was yoga, Ayurveda, organic food, all of that. And I became determined, and I did a lot of, actually, I was in the same meditation resort that I'm in now. And part of the work that I did was a lot of crying meditation, a lot of laughter meditation, silence. I did everything, you name it, 10 days of silence, weeks of crying, weeks of journaling. And eventually, I healed. Naturally, I reversed the disease. And the thing is, was not about the disease reversal as much as me reflecting on, hold on, what if this was a cancer? What if this was undiscovered till it became a cancer? And funny, my well, not funny, but like in that coincidence situation, my uncle had passed away the year before that from cancer because it was undiscovered. And then when they discovered it, it was too late. So for me, it was so real to go, oh my God, what if this was really the end of my life? Would have I been proud about my life with everything that I've done? And the answer was no. I'm not proud of what I've done. None of what I did means anything if I was going to die. And what I was thirsty for, this is where the penny dropped on the answer. What I was thirsty for was to have impact on this world. So whenever I kick the bucket, then I would have left my mark on this world. So this is when I discovered that I was thirsty for having impact.
Impact.
All right? Yeah.
That thirsty metaphor was powerful because if you ask the average person, what are they thirsty for? What do they want out of life? There's a blank stare and they have not gone there. They have not given that consideration as to what that would look like.
Yeah. So that was and that was not only I know that is everybody's situation at a certain point of time. And even when we find an answer, you want to more refine it more and more. So and the best example I can give is although I found out that I was thirsty for having impact, I did not know exactly how. Yeah, so I knew I want to have impact, but what does that mean? A teacher is having impact on a school. A parent is having impact on their children. So what did it mean that I want to have impact? So in a way, the answer gave me another question of, well, how do I do it exactly?
Yeah.
A few months later, I'm continuing my journey. One day I wake up, I'm like, okay, I went to India in 2012, 2013. I wake up one day and I'm like, okay, I'm done. It's time to go back. 2013, I arrived to Dubai. I started delivering an inspirational talk called Cavalli to Manali,
yeah.
Which was literally what I just told you now, but in 45-minute inspirational talk, talking about all the juicy details of the whole journey from Cavalli lifestyle that I was living into Manali in India, where I met my Swami. And a few months later, I was sitting in Media One Hotel in Dubai, Media City. And I'm working and a random person passing by sees me and turns and comes straight at me. He goes, hey, you're that speaker guy. I said, yeah. He goes, you did your talk about India. I'm like, yeah. He goes, you changed my life.
Ooh.
And I was like, wow, that's now I know what I want to do and how I want to do it, which is I want to be able to speak. I want to be able to help people and guide them on a journey without them necessarily, because one guy walked up to me and says, listen, I'm married, I've got kids, I've got a job. I can't buy a one-way ticket to India. How am I supposed to now find what I'm thirsty for? And this has also triggered me then from there to go, okay, I can help people. Speaking is one of them, but also doing other things. And one of them was launching Passion Sundays. It was a similar to what you're doing now as a talk show. Okay. I was doing a lot of opening. I was pretty much the opening guy for all the international speakers and authors that came to Dubai at that stage, because nobody was doing much of it. And I was even willing to work for free just to show what I can do. And a bit of blessings, I have to say, always, no matter what you do and how hard you work, you do need a blessing from, regardless of what your faith or belief is. You need to believe in something bigger than us, that is a divine intervention that opens doors and gateways, but then you've got to do the work. So I had a lot of opportunities, and I was hardworking enough to capitalize on the opportunities. I always say luck is opportunity meets preparedness. So for me, I was lucky because I was preparing so much that every time there was an opportunity with an international author or a speaker, I was there, I was showing up, I was doing the work. And I did a first talk show with Dr. Marshall Goldsmith. So he's world's number one. Yeah, he's world's number one executive coach, coaches 150 out of Fortune 500 CEOs. And he gave me the first time advice. He said, Mustafa, write a book. And I'm like, but I'm not a native English speaker. And although honestly, I hate reading and I hate writing. I love learning. I love audiobooks. I love courses. I love workshops. I love online programs, but I'm hardly a guy to sit and hold a book for long enough. I'm too hyper and too passionate per se. And he goes, write a book. Then Brian Tracy, same thing, told me, write a book. Every single one of these top guys, the gurus that I aspire to emulate, would say, write a book. And I'm like, fine, if the teachers say, write a book, write a book. But it took me a long way to do it. So I did 160 face-to-face interviews. So there, I refused to do anything that was online. For me, I wanted to sit face-to-face because looking in people's eyes while I'm doing the interviews and the interaction, it was a lot of effort. So I literally was traveling at my own expense, making zero income on that show. And I've interviewed people all the way from US through Europe, Middle East, Singapore, all the way to Australia. And then at the end of all of that, I took all of that knowledge, distilled it. And I got that idea, not to say that I'm a genius. I got the idea, okay, from Napoleon Hill. Because Think and Grow Rich was actually written in the same way. Napoleon Hill went and interviewed all the top guys. I'm like, okay, you got to learn. You know, you see, the smart people learn from others. I'm like, I like that. So I started learning and researching from the best. Who am I to talk about passion? Yes, yeah. I bought a one-way ticket India.
Yes. You know, Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich, that was the first book I read in high school. And it changed my entire thinking about how I was going to pursue this post university thing. Didn't have all the pieces in place, but that was the first body of work that I said, you could figure this out, and you know, positiveness, thinking through it and all of that. Yeah, so cool.
Yeah, look, I mean, this book, for those who might or might not know, but this book is the Bible of the whole personal growth, self-help and transformation industry, bar none, because I'm the guy who always looks for the teachers, for example. And all of them refer to a book, and then that book refers to another book, and everybody eventually roots back to Napoleon Hill. That guy was at the days of black and white. It was old school, getting on an airplane. There was non-digital. So I said, I want to do it old school way. I want to do it hard work way. I want the one-to-one interactions. And I distilled all of those learnings into a workshop that was called the Passion Journey, where I help people find their passion without needing to buy a one-way ticket to India. That was a distillation of the interviews and all the learnings that I've gone through searching for my own passion from 2008 till I bought a one-way ticket to India and everything I learned after that. So I distilled all of that into a workshop, ran the workshop for long enough, turned it into an online program, took the online program and then turned it into a book. And that book became an international bestseller, which then gave me that brand that you saw, which is Mr. Passion and the Passionpreneur and so on. So yeah. From there, and here's the interesting twist. And I said, well, luck is opportunity meets preparedness, because how this even pivoted was something that I would have never imagined. Remember, I said, I hate reading, I hate writing, and I wasn't sure how I even got the first book out. That took me years and a lot of work. And eventually what happened is, because people were like, how on earth did you even associate with such big names? And they're there for you, showing up, endorsing you, endorsing your books. And I said, well, I was given an advice to write a book. So my advice to you is write a book. And they go, okay, can you help me?
Okay.
And this is how I ended up launching Passionpreneur Publishing. And what you see behind me is some of the books that I help people write and publish. So till date, where we've just crossed over 4 years, so that this business started in 2018. And till date, I've helped about me and our team, of course, us, I speak in us, 150 plus authors, CEOs, executives, entrepreneurs, leaders, coaches, speakers that have a knowledge to share. And that's the genre we specialize in. And we help. So I went from somebody who could barely write a book into now I'm on my fourth book and I've helped 150 and we're counting. At the peak, we were onboarding an author a day.
Wow.
Sorry, an author a week. An author a week. So that's about 50 a year.
Yeah. So you have a new book coming out. Let's flip that up on the screen. And walk us through the inspiration for that. And this is number four. And give us some insights on that. So it'll come up on the screen in just a bit.
So this book, while the team gets it up on screen, this book is called Slingshot, The Practical Guide to Becoming a Master of Your Destiny, Not a Victim of Your History. Mm-hmm. So this book was triggered in my own journey where I'll give you a quick summary. So as much as there's all these highs, whatever goes up must come down. Yeah. So at the peak of all of this, by the end of 2020, I go through a divorce with everything a divorce brings. So the whole of 2019 pretty much was like the separation year. And it's very draining because you've invested a lot into a relationship with somebody that you had said till death do us part, but death came earlier because it's a relational death. And then you go through all these emotions. Eventually, we got to a point where we decided to end the marriage. And then I left everything and I bought another ticket to India and then the pandemic hits. And so I couldn't even deal with my healing journey. I ended up taking the first airplane out of India into Australia, where I had my immigration settled and where the business was set up. I land in Melbourne thinking, okay, I'm going to figure my way around. And that was March 2020. Who would have known the pandemic, the biggest pandemic in history, started, and I ended up having to deal with a divorce, the aftermath of that, lockdown in a new country, alone, no friends, no family. A year later, my dad catches COVID and passes away, and then a few months after that, my mom gets a brain stroke, ends up in the hospital. So I basically reached a point where I'm almost collapsing.
Yeah, tsunami.
So then I started losing my own mind and I started thinking, you know what? You got to practice what you preach.
Yeah.
You got to practice what you preach. I'm the guy who's serving the medicine. I got to have my own medicine. And when life hits me hard, really, this is when you walk the talk. You know, I when I do talks about passionate leadership, I say, you know, what's the longest distance a leader has to walk?
Is that a question for me?
Well, it's a trick question, but yeah, I'd like to get some ideas. What would you think the longest distance a leader has to walk?
To realize who they are?
Yes, and the way well done. And to do that, the longest distance a leader has to walk is between their mouth and their feet.
Is
to walk the talk, you see, and this is when life throws you a curveball. And that's the thing, is when people think, oh, Mr. Passion, I'm Mr. Passion because I'm just passionate. No, I'm actually Mr. Passion because every time life throws me a curveball, I take it on the chin and stand up and get up again. And that's really where for me that I gotta walk the talk on actually healing my own past, mastering my own mindset. And then using tools that are at my disposal. And the book Slingshot was written during that period from old material that I had from previous interviews and things like that, triggered by the pandemic, by all the challenges that I had to help me. And the analogy of slingshot is sometimes we're all trying to go forward.
Yeah.
And this is where generally the executive coaching school of thought is forget, you don't talk about the past, you just go. On the other hand, the school of thought of things that I've learned in India, it's all about looking back. So it's about going to the past. It's about healing, but that's like peeling an onion. You never finish. So for me, it was about bringing both together. Mm-hmm. So you take a step back before you can take two steps forward and slingshot into the future. So I had to deal. I couldn't ignore. I mean, with the amount of things I was dealing with, I couldn't ignore a divorce and a move and a father passing away and a mom. I had to deal with these emotions. Once I did Then I was able to slingshot into the future, and then this book came out, and a lot of the other successes of us doubling our business. By the way, this publishing business, we doubled literally year to year during the pandemic. We went from 25 authors, 50 authors, 100 authors, 150 authors.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. You know, the metaphor I thought about pulling the slingshot back, because as a kid, I had a slingshot, and you pull it back, but all of your energy. And I can understand that now that you have explained that, because that could be all the past failures. Everything didn't work. And I got to pull all this back. And then at one point, I'm going to let go and I'm going to prepare myself forward.
Yeah. So that's how this book came about. And actually, what everybody has seen now, this is the first time this book is publicly seen, FYI. Literally, the call before this. This is an exclusive for the CEO series with Ron Thomas. So it's because I literally got off the call with the designers finishing it off. I've been blessed to get the endorsement for the book by Stephen M. R. Covey, the author of The Speed of Trust from the Franklin Covey Organization. And the foreword was written by Marissa Peer, world-renowned therapist, hypnotherapist. So really a lot of practical, because you see, everything I do is about practicality. I'm a guy who learned it the hard way. So I bring a bit of the science, but I also bring practicality, because a lot of the sciences are too theoretical. It's like trying to, and you know why I adopted that? I remember I used to go to a chiropractor in 2012 before I go to my, you know, to India to fix my back. And one day he walks in and he goes, "Sorry, dude, today I'm not feeling that good, you know, like my back is hurting, so I'm not sure I'll be able to adjust you properly." I said, "Hold on, have you never had a back pain?" He goes, "No." I'm like, "So how on earth have you been trying to fix my back pain when you don't even know what I'm feeling? You just read, you know," and all respect to all doctors, I'm not saying, but there are things that for me, I like them to be a bit more personal. He was an amazing doctor. He always did his best for me. However, for me, there was something missing where, like, you don't know what I'm feeling until today. You can't sort it out for me. So I needed things that are practical, because we're not cars. You can read a mechanic book and fix a car. We are human beings. So dealing with psychology and psychiatry and all of these things, I've been throughout my journey, you know, before I went to India, I was on antidepressants. I used to be alcohol, tobacco, sleeping pills, heart medication. So, you know, these are all the juicy details that I mentioned would be in the inspirational talk. But what was important for me is to be able to bring a tool that I know if somebody grabs one of my books, they open it, they read some theory, but then they have to do the work.
Okay.
Because I cannot bench press on your behalf. I'm the, like a gym coach. You know, you come in, I gotta yell and scream and shout and give you the technique to do it, but you're gonna have to bench press yourself to get the results. And all my books are practical. You open it, there's worksheets, there's exercises, fill in the blanks, there's journaling. So that's kind of, it's a practical tool for people to be able to deal with it, with their emotional baggages and mastering their mindset. And the other thing I would like to add is also, this is very continuous process. So it's not a one-time thing. People think these things you do them once. And the last chapter in this book, it says, keep brushing your teeth. It's not something you do once. If you want to heal your past and master your mindset, slingshotting yourself is a continuous process, because I can guarantee you life will knock you out. I can guarantee you life will knock you out. And it just happens that you got to learn the habit of doing this. So you go, okay, I get knocked out, I get up again. I get knocked out, I get up again.
You know, you mentioned do the work, and I want to talk about do the work as it relates to leadership, because, you know, you hear leaders say, you know, this company is, we're about our people, we do this, we do this. And then every instance when they have the opportunity to do that, they don't do it. So leadership always talks big talk. How can they bring it down to a level that the lowest person on the totem pole could really be passionate about working for this organization?
Beautiful question. I love it. Because that's a question I've asked a few people during my Passion Sundays interviews. And I remember one specific person, two stand out. It's Dr. Marshall Goldsmith and Brian Tracy. So with Brian Tracy, I asked him, I said, so is it really important for the company to invest in helping employees find their passion? Of course, I am thinking and hoping he would say yes, because that helps me also sell more of my services. And he goes, no, it's not their job as much as it's not their job to chew your food. And in a way, he's right. I mean, of course, It's not their job, but currently, how, especially in the last couple of years, with the mass exodus from businesses and with everything, people are needing more passion and purpose in their job. So it is, in my opinion, becoming a must. But I get where Brian Tracy is coming from, because also if people become dependent on, oh, you have to empower me. Well, it doesn't work. Nobody can empower you. Nobody can do it for you. And the other one is with Dr. Marshall. When I asked him a similar question, he said in all the people and the organizations that he coaches, he's never seen any of these CEOs depressed once. Not once.
That's now, great.
And that's interesting, because this is where I tell you where I bring my unique angle to it. And I get where Dr. Marshall's coming from, because you need to lead by example in answer to your question here. So if you want a passionate organization, you can only be passionate. You can only lead a passionate organization when you are passionate. You cannot lead a passionate organization through strategy, because you know the saying, culture eats strategy for breakfast. You can put any strategy. I've done it. I've done the work in a lot of organizations. And unless there's true investment, not just by HR nagging the CEO to bring Mustafa as a speaker, that helps. But the continuity is, if these people go in and feel a genuine change over time, like cultural change takes about 12 to 18 months at least. And you need to walk the talk consistently. We have an interesting saying in Arabic, and I'm going to say it and translate it. إِذَا كَانَ رَبُّ الْبَيْتِ بِالدُّفِّ ضَارِبًا فَشِيمَةُ أَهْلِ الدَّارِ الرَّقْصُ. So what that translates to, kind of, if the man of the house is a drummer, the rest of the house are belly dancers.
Okay, you froze up on that. If the man of the house is the drummer,
is it like a tabla drummer, the rest of the house are belly dancers.
Ah, okay.
So people take the cue from the top. I can guarantee you, and I know you probably know that, Ron, when you go to do consultancy and strategy with organizations, I can read the organization from the first email interaction and how the reception deals with my phone call without them knowing who I am. I can read all the way to the top. And I've almost been 80, 90% correct, because the way the reception is, the way they handle calls, the attitude in emails, the attitude in communication, the attitude of purchasing and procurement speaks to how the boss treats everybody under them. So passionate organization needs first a passionate leader. Passionate leader needs to be on passion, on purpose, needs to be somebody that truly believes in what they're doing.
But, you know, going back to the conversation we've been having, passionate leaders, they will always tell you, and I deal with a lot of C-suites, and they always tell you that everything is on point. But I say every survey you look at, it says the leadership is here, mindset, but there is a deduction as it goes down the arc chart. Because they feel that they are communicating properly. But I always say, just because you give a speech, you mention a few key points, you have to cascade that down through the organization.
But that only happens, and well said, Ron, that only happens when you do as I do, not do as I say. So what you're talking about is do as I say. They come in and they bring a Mustafa and they bring a Ron and they bring the likes of, and they say, okay, we've invested. Now you guys have to perform, but they're not performing. They're not passionate. You know, it's you got to, that's what I say. Remember, longest distance a leader has to walk is between their mouth and their feet. So the mouth part is very easy. That's much easier than doing the work.
Okay, so let's take a look at this now. We've been talking about COVID and the impact it's had on workforces and whatnot. A lot of people are disillusioned. Organizations are trying to make you come back and work in an office 5 days a week and all these kind of structures that are alien to the post-COVID experience. What advice would you give for C-suite as to how to approach a post-COVID workforce?
Oh, beautiful. And I know it's a trick question that you're throwing at me, because you know that for the last now few months, I've been living officially as a nomad executive, traveling, living out of a camper van. So we'll get to that separately. However, my advice is practicality. I heard a saying when I was young. It was attributed to a gentleman that I don't remember his name. He was a World War fighter pilot. And he said, rules are for the wise to guide and for the fool to follow.
Okay.
So the reality is there's a rule before pandemic where everybody had to be on time because you had to manage people on time and you had to. And unfortunately, that rule tipped 180 degrees where there's a rule, everybody has to be able to work from home. It's not neither nor. It's not, it doesn't work that way. Every organization, every dynamic, every business, every time, every season, and that's a lot more dynamic. Now, I can tell you that means it's a lot more exhaustive. Mm-hmm. And only the genuine is gonna survive that type of setup. So now leaders have two types of options. One, stick to the old school and understand that the foundation has shaken already and water is already seeping into the old system and it's gonna collapse. Or they adapt, okay? And if they adopt, what they're gonna do is they're gonna adapt by adopting a new flexible mentality that is looking at what their client needs and wants are, how they conduct business, okay? And then how their team delivers that. Because one of the biggest underestimated assets is the human capital. And I know it keeps being talked about. I will tell you my experience doing this similar work to what I do when I travel the world, I've realized it's not this all the same. Middle East, we have certain culture. You go to Australia and New Zealand, totally distinctly different culture. It's a supplier market, and that includes the employees. You put pressure on the employees, they're going to turn around and go, nah, I don't like it, I'll go work somewhere else, because there isn't enough team members and qualified people to grow, because then the market dynamics are different. You come to places like Dubai, Singapore, the new recent upcoming skyrocket economies are all about hard work and go, 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 go. So if you're dealing with somebody who's used to that lifestyle and that business, you have to handle them totally different than if you're dealing with a different person. Not to say one is better or worse than the other. You got to know what vehicle you're driving and what terrain you're driving and what your customers want. So if I ask you a question now, which is better, a Ferrari or a Land Cruiser?
For me, it would be the Ferrari.
Well, let me put you in a Ferrari and throw you in the middle of the desert and let's see how useful your Ferrari is.
Okay.
That's exactly the point. You see, everybody thinks I got to run a Ferrari as an organization, but who says running a Ferrari is the best organization? That is the best organization in a certain context. Certain context requires a totally different setup. Just to let you know, with Passionpreneur Publishing, I don't physically have an office where any of my employees sit. I run operations cross-continental. I have teams in Australia, in multiple cities. I have teams in Philippines. I have teams in India.
Yeah.
Some of them I have never met face to face, never, ever. Now that is very exhausting because I have to be able to be on my toes all the time and be plugged into, but this business is my passion. What I'm speaking is my passion. Doing the books is my passion. So for me, it's easy to accommodate while I'm having fun to do some business. It's not a chore. Sometimes it gets exhaustive, but I also learn to manage my mind and manage my work and build a system that allows my team to enjoy the same. I'm like, listen, I don't care what are your working hours. You do what you have to do. You do what you have to do as long as you do it. Now, I have my lead coach. She's a single mom. So I have to cater to her need of working because she works from home. She needs to take care of kids. And with the time zone difference, I'm coaching a CEO in Dubai. It's already time for her kids to be home. So then I go, you know what, I'll pay for your babysitter. Mm-hmm. So that is not a typical conversation a CEO wants to be having. So the CEO got to step away from being a CEO and being a genuine business owner. The difference is when they step into a bit of an entrepreneur mentality rather than just an executive mentality where, well, it's not mine. And you think, well, listen, this is a big family. What do I have to do to keep the business running? Because if I lose this person, I cannot afford losing them. Then you'll understand that suddenly there's a shift in how we do business. It takes a lot of work, but that's the starting point.
Yeah, so that's the human to human. That's a quote from Adnan Dhirani, who you know. He talks the human to human versus the CEO to workers, you know, kind of empathetic, bringing it down to that level and trying to meet some in some place.
And there's a bit of parenting here. Let me be clear. That doesn't mean, oh, suddenly it's okay for everybody to chill home and do whatever it is. You know, a lot of these things are a learning curve. Because for me, that came away from me putting pressure on the coach saying, well, listen, I got a complaint a couple of times from authors that you know, they would hear things and kids would jump into the screen and all of that. So in a way, I was wearing my CEO hat going, well, that's not my problem. I am paying you to be working. And when it's working hours, you figure out your it's your problem, not mine. But then I had to actually sit down and reflect and take my hat off and say, listen, she's a valuable resource for me. She's one of my best performers. She's my lead person. She's an amazing person. We've built a great relationship together. We've been through ups and downs. So that's a big investment for both of us in relationship and in learning. How can I make it work for her and for me? Rather than expecting her to do it, I said, well, listen, I'll take care of it. Financially, it's not a huge investment. I mean, for as much as I could care as a CEO, it should be her problem to think about that. But I also realized that she has a lot on her plate. So why don't I support her? And in this, I said, well, listen, if this is happening at any time you're coaching, it doesn't matter. That's a company expense now. Mm. But guess what? I don't pay office rent.
Yeah.
I don't pay office rent. So why not take the saving I'm making from the office rent and make my team's life easier? Another team member that I had was in India, junior team member. Well, they didn't have a good computer. I said, listen, we'll buy the computer. We'll buy you a green screen. I'll buy you a podcast microphone. I'll buy you lights because they need to be better heard and better seen or whatever it is. So I'm just giving small examples. Of course, as you scale, it becomes different. And this is where the work becomes. It's not about compliance. When the leader is genuinely invested, what's going to happen is the HR person becomes more invested and then everybody becomes invested. And then, trust me, my team tells you I'm a tough love guy.
Yeah.
And my even my coaches and my authors and anybody executives who come to me for coaching, I'm a no BS guy. Straight to the point, I say it as it is, and you know me personally. I piss off more people that there's a Mustafa haters club, and I don't care because these are not the people I want to be with. But my team tells you is.
Yeah, it's a good pissing off people, you know, so you do a good way of doing that as opposed to the negative side.
Because I genuinely care.
Yeah.
You know, I genuinely care. And if I do my best for my team, then it's time for me to go, hold on, what's the excuse now?
Yeah.
You know, I can call BS on them. And I say, listen, sorry, that cannot be an excuse because I took care of your kid's situation. I took care of whatever you need. You need a break. I've done everything I can. Can we now stop excuses and can you do 1, 2, 3? And the minute I started stepping into that space, my team's performance started going skyrocketing in a way that I never thought. Look, I don't consider myself a great manager generally because I'm a go, 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 go guy. I have a high expectations. I put too much pressure on people. However, when I shifted because I had to learn to cope with the new way of doing business and realize that this freedom it gives me also for me to be traveling the world, being anywhere I want while I still run a business that is paying my bills, giving me money, giving me exposure, opening the houses and paying for the families of the people that work in it while everybody loves their life. That's truly what living passionately is about. So it's not just about writing the book, it's about me walking the talk.
But here's a thought. As you were walking through that scenario, I'm thinking you switch from that person to a coach with that worker who was having babysitting issues. And you were at a certain point, you said, okay, so we've done this. So now you're saying, okay, it's up to you. Isn't that the coaching mentality that you kind of switched into?
You want to know, you put me on the spot and I'm going to have to be honest in calling BS on myself also, is I tried to step into the coach and that worked a disaster.
Really?
Because a coach is like a doctor. And typically, if you were speaking to a coach, there's a confidentiality as much as when speaking to a doctor. And a lot of times you want to really talk about your boss, not necessarily in a very good way.
Yeah.
So if I'm the coach and I'm the CEO, it doesn't work. So I had to step out from being the coach while I set the frameworks and agreements and also trust that these people, I am here when you need me. And yes, I use coaching techniques in my process, but I stopped being a coach and I genuinely started caring for them so also they can care for me equally.
Okay.
And that takes a bit of tough surrender because that's not the old culture. So I'll tell you, there's a bit of transition in the culture of what a CEO or a leader is. In the past, the CEO used to be the all-knowing guy.
Oh, if you need the...
Okay, when did that get eliminated, Mr. Google? Enter Mr. Google, because now with Google, you can type in and find any answer you want. Technology enables you to go on a CRM system and find all the answers. So suddenly the leader is no longer the person that needs to know everything. So in that case, the leader has to adopt to what the role of the leader is. And this is not only on a personal level. I delivered the talk to the United Nations, to the UNDP, if I'm not mistaken, one of the United Nations agencies before the pandemic. It was in Uzbekistan. And I was talking about the role of government being disrupted equally, because a government is a leader. A government as an organization is a leader, and the role is getting disrupted because in the past, it was about protecting resources because you had a land, you needed somebody with a gun or with a knife or whatever it is to protect from thieves. But now everything is digitized. So now the government role is to be an enabler, not a protector. They need to enable people to do business. So they need to allow you better regulations, better systems, better taxations, better finances, better, whatever it is. So they're an enabler. And the role of a leader in an organization is a government. The role, the CEO is the governor and the board is the government. So these guys have to really wear a different hat and think, we have a new dynamic. We have to go back to the drawing board. So they have to get fit first up here.
Yeah. But you know what? One quick point to that, and that, because I wanted to move on to something else. I noticed in Washington, D.C., there was a hearing on TikTok. And I keep going back to that. And this was maybe a couple of months ago. And I watched part of the hearings, and I'm listening to the people ask questions. They didn't have a clue as to what TikTok was. But because the staff had given them some questions, they were trying to come across as being authoritative. And it just showed that you don't even know what, you've never even used this tool. But meanwhile, you want to block everything because of whatever it was. I mean, whatever the issue that came above that. So when you talk about government as an enabler, as being innovative, and that happens a lot in the UAE. If you have a government speaker, that's the top of the food chain. But is the government innovative? Because in a lot of cases, they aren't. They've been doing things the same way for the same amount of time, and there's nothing changing.
Yeah, well, that's a deep conversation. I delivered a talk, actually. I have a talk called Passionovate, How Passion Enables Innovation. And in part of that, I talk about the evolution of the process of innovation. And naturally, the cycle is when we get good at something, we end up repeating it. That's logical. You do something well, you end up repeating it. But the repetition itself becomes counterproductive because then you become stale. So then there has to be disruption in the process.
Okay. Which should be consistent. So as we begin to close the session out, tell us about important influences in your growing up that was, you always kind of go back to, there was an anchor that you still think about.
God. Tough question to answer, because I will tell you, we have, again, maybe influences aside from my dad, you know, who's been a big inspiration for me. But I think also, you know, I had to learn to be my own inspiration in life, because then there's nobody, no glass ceiling for me. And there's a saying, it says, "Al-hikmatu dallatu al-mu'min aynama wajadaha al-taqafaha." And it's a verse that my dad taught me in Arabic. And that means the wisdom is the holy grail of the believer. Wherever he finds it, he'll grab it.
Yeah.
So I'm a guy who's always seeking wise people in my life.
Yeah.
So at any stage, Dr. Marshall Goldsmith, a huge impact in my life. The Guru in the Caves, a huge impact in my life. Incidents that happen in my life on the road while I'm traveling. I can tell you crazy stories of how a taxi driver taught me a lesson that I'll never forget. So there's a lot of these things that happen with me where I think I know it all until I tune into the wisdom of the moment and I go, you know what? Thank you very much. You have humbled me and taught me a lesson that I'm happy to learn from you, because otherwise life would have smacked me hard to learn that lesson. So really, inspiration for me is a day-to-day thing. I'm hungry all the time for things that inspire me. And that's one of the best things I've done now to gain a big dose of inspiration, is me literally giving up everything and driving off in a camper van for the last few months.
Okay. You've got to give us that story. Give us a short version of that, because we're coming up on the end of the camper life. To give you some background, Mustafa sent me a note, and he says, I got rid of everything. I'm now living in a camper van. I'm like, camper? And he shows me a picture near a river or whatever it was. And this was the van he's living out of. And that lifestyle.
So the simplest way I can summarize it is I'm walking the talk. I wrote the book on living passionately. And that was the theory book. And I started living parts of it, but I was still confined to my own space. And with all the pressure that I was getting from life, what I told you about the pressures, and even after I finished the book, I have more things that, you know, a lot of them might be personal, life-related, health-related. I'm dealing with so much more than what I just told you that one day I turned around, I'm like, hold on, life is going to put me in the corner. Nothing puts me in the corner. I own my life, and I slingshot myself out of the corner that I was in, mastered my mindset, and I said, you know what? I don't need anything. I don't need a house. I don't need an office. I don't need a desk. I don't need a couch. I just going to take a camper van because I really feel like doing it. And I'm going to test myself. Am I able to keep an organization in the caliber of Passionpreneur Publishing running while I'm on the road living in a camper van where a toilet is a luxury, a hot shower is a luxury, cooking a meal is a luxury, finding safe space is a luxury. And I reached a point where a couple of weeks back, I was in a coin laundry shop in the camper van. So I put my laundry, waiting for my laundry to dry. And I closed the $25,000 publishing deal with an executive from somewhere around the world to be one of our authors. And I went back to it. And I'm like, that's exactly what it's about. Because for me, it's about, I want to be at a stage of my life where I'm enjoying nature, where I'm traveling, but I'm not hippie. I'm on top of my game. I'm still top executive coach, top publisher, because I have a responsibility towards the people. And my team is living their life they want. Everybody lives the life they want. I'm not saying everybody should buy a one-way ticket or everybody should get a camper van. But I say when you know what is important to you, it's very easy to say no to what is not important. So with that, what I would conclude all of this, if there's one thing you take out of this conversation we had, is if today was the last day of your life, what would you regret not doing? Think about that and start pursuing that, because you never know when that last day is going to come. And resources, stories, it's all stories. The world's going to just knock you over. But when you're fighting for something that is truly meaningful, you are going to truly live passionately.
My man, let me say this to you. You know, one of the goals of the show, and we started this during COVID, was to bring together leaders like yourself, entrepreneurs, to talk about their career journeys and experiences they've gone through, leadership lessons and all of that. And you gave us a masterclass on it, on your journey today. And we really, really appreciate it. And can you give us some closing words on, you know, being the guest and expounding on your transition?
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity, Ron. And I love what you're doing, because I'll tell you, the biggest winner in all of this is you. The interviews you're doing, the amount of information you're collecting, the amount of ahas you're getting, you know, you're literally doing exactly what I'm saying. It's the inspiration. You just get something from me, and you're like a bee that's just going from one flower to the next, and you're going to make the honey and distill all of that. And then you share that nectar. And that by itself is going to be the biggest transformation thing, or it is the biggest transformational thing you ever do in your life at this stage of your life. And you take that and pay it forward is the next important thing. Not just for you, that's for everybody. And I say for the listeners, when you like, share, comment on this show, it helps, number one, aside from helping Ron, helping myself spread the message, it actually helps you, because you flex your muscles on paying it forward. You know, knowledge is like money. Knowledge is a blessing. Knowledge is something that people have to work for. What I told you now in a span of 45 minutes to an hour took me 10 years and 20 years of my life of heartache and hardships, and Ron is taking time, and there's people in the background managing this show and so on. When you pay it forward, you become more in the sharing concept. You become in the love, sharing the love. You start attracting more goodness in your life, because if everybody gives something little to the next person, it keeps going around. It'll come back to you. It'll come back to everyone. So my advice to everybody is share the love that you got from today. And if you need anything, look me up, Mustafa Hamoui, Mustafa.com. And of course, Ron is the master over here.
My man. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're going to close out now. So thank you so much for being a guest. Hang on, and I'll come back in just a second. Thank you.